What's up, everybody? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricardo Verandes, also known as Ricky Verandes, and today we have a great returning guest for you. He's an actor, filmmaker, screenwriter, producer. The list goes on and on and on. He also hosts a great show called Buzzsaw, which you can find on YouTube. It covers conspiracies, UFOs, alternative history, ancient aliens, so many different interesting stuff. So check that out. He also hosts a show with Tyro Ventura, which is Jesse Ventura's son, and Tabitha Wallace on RT America called Watching the Hawks. You can also find Watching the Hawks on their YouTube channel. Just look up Watching the Hawks. You'll find the show. It's a great news show that covers current events in an unbiased manner. And my guest today is Sean Stone. He's been on the show before. Last time he was on was a while ago, so I'm not sure what we talked about, but I'm sure it was a great conversation. So go back in the archives, check out that conversation, and hopefully you enjoy today's conversation. He's also the son of legendary filmmaker Oliver Stone, which I'm sure you guys might be familiar with. Also, remember, if you want to support this show, if you enjoy this conversation and other podcasts I've done, and if you can support it, even if it's just a dollar a month, whatever it may be, please do. It's really appreciated. All that money goes to keeping this show going and justifying doing the show instead of doing stuff that actually can make me money. That helps. Also, the music, if you like the music, if you like the music that you hear in the beginning and in the end and in the middle of this podcast, then please support the show by purchasing that music anywhere you can find digital downloads, Amazon, Google Play, iTunes. It's available everywhere, and all that money also goes to supporting the podcast. So I think you can also stream it on Spotify and other streaming apps. So just look up Theory 6, which is my music project. If you like the opening song, the song's called The Ripple Effect, so look that up. And it's also the title of a little EP I put out a couple years ago, so check that out. So a couple great ways to support the show financially. Of course, like I always tell you guys, if you can't support the show financially, share the show. I really appreciate everybody who does that, who rates the show, writes reviews. I usually don't read the reviews just because I'm always worried. But recently, for some reason, I was curious, and I went on a couple websites just to see what people are saying about the podcast. And I was really happy to see that it was about 99.9% all positive. And I can't thank you guys enough, because really, it's just me ranting on. And I know that I don't always do the best job at interviewing and the best job at staying on topic or even finishing a sentence or a idea at times. So I really appreciate all you guys that love me for all my positives and my many, many negatives. And I'm just glad people are enjoying this, because I'm definitely enjoying doing this. So thanks again, guys. I guess that's it for now. And I'll see you on the next one. Peace. Hey, Sean. Can you hear me?
Hey, man. Yes, got you.
Awesome, awesome. Great. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
You got it. You got it.
It's been, it's last time you were on, I think quite a few years ago. And you have a lot of work since then, a couple documentaries that are awesome. I liked your most recent one, Hollywood DC, that you're doing on RT. And I know you did Century of War, and it just constantly putting out great work. I was actually listening to just recently a interview you did on TYT, an old one that you did, I think in 2016. And it was funny, because you were bringing something up that I've heard Dan Carlin talk about and other historians that I think is kind of overseen and not too many people have this perspective, but you know how the importance of World War One, and how World War One kind of was, you can kind of trace back how everything turned out the way it is today because of World War One, and you know, getting into that war, obviously carving up the Middle East, all these different things happened because of World War One. And I know James Corbett, who's a regular guest on my show, he just did a three-part series on World War One, and I kind of feel like until James Corbett recently, it was kind of a neglected part of history. You know, everybody kind of talks about World War Two and the importance of it, and I think it's sexy because, you know, Hitler is just a fascinating person, and the Nazis were so fascinating. And yet, World War One, a lot of people believe if World War One didn't happen, then, you know, World War Two wouldn't have happened. and you know, obviously all these other things, that these chain of events that happen afterwards. And coming from somebody who studies history and obviously is, you know, with watching the Hawks and Buzzsaw, you're also keeping track of what's going on in the news today. How important do you think, you know, the stuff that's going on today, how important do you think World War I was to understanding even current events?
Well, sure. I think the most interesting thing coming out recently I've heard about is this country of Tataria. Now, have you heard this recent, like more recent evidence unearthing a Tatarian civilization?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's something for people to look into, because I heard about it only recently. I was actually there in Tatarstan, and which is now like basically the relic of Tataria. But essentially, you know, the Tatars consider like everything in like across the expanse of Russia, especially to the east, to Mongolia, Genghis Khan. But apparently Tataria has evidence of a civilization that really expanded all the way from like from Japan and even maybe parts of Australia all the way to the west in Russia. And this civilization, there's the new theory that's going, it has been buried from history, and actually was very much targeted through the whole 20th century, in a sense, to erase this aspect of our history, even though we know of Genghis Khan's conquests and the fact that many people are related to him by blood, or at least to the Mongol lineage by conquest. But this whole notion of Tataria having a lot more influence and prominence is fascinating, especially because I was in, like I said, I was in Kazan, which is now Tatarstan in Russia, and the architecture is so beautiful and such like a unique architecture that it really does make me, it struck me as, wow, what is this civilization? And they have the dragon symbolism very prominently, and they're like, they have this relationship to the dragon people, and it really did strike me as an interesting thing. So the fact that Tartaria is not coming up is something worth looking at. It's not my base, it's not my education as far as what I studied, because I got into the issue of World War I when I was in college doing my thesis, which I turned into my book, New World Order. That was very much looking at the British Empire basically preserving itself by bringing America into the fold, kind of like in the 1984 book, the fact of like this Oceania, like this sort of like this massive empire of Oceania. I can't remember the names of them. Like, there was like Pan-Eurasia or something, Pacifica and Oceania. Well, that's what America was done to America through the First World War. It was a co-opting of the American Nationalist Republic by this imperialist faction, you know, that essentially hijacked us, because America had no business in the First World War. We were a mixture of German, Irish, British, French, Black, Latin, Mexican, I mean, Puerto Rican, you name it, like, you know, islanders. We were such a hodgepodge collection of peoples, right? Russian, you know, of all these different lands. So why America chose to fight on the side of the British and the French in the First World War is something that people rarely answer, aside from saying, well, the Germans sunk the Lusitania. Actually, it seems that Churchill was involved in staging that, because he was, I think, the British Admiralty at the time. He was like one of the heads of the British Admiralty. And essentially, they put arms on that ship and let the Germans know that it was full of weapons. And then to the American public, they always said it was just a bunch of innocent, passengers that were sunk. But it was a bit like 9/11 in that regard. It was an intentional destruction to perpetuate in a war. World War I directly led to World War II because of the sanctions of Germany, the reparations deals, you name it. I mean, there was so much that Whitman was ashamed by the First World War that ultimately led to resurgence in nationalism and Hitler and all this.
What I think is interesting is, and there's a documentary that called The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire. I don't know if you've ever watched it, but there's other documentaries and other people who kind of feel like the U.S. has only been a extent of the British Empire. You know, it's a continuation of it. Do you subscribe to that? Do you think that's true?
I'm sorry, I lost the question. It's only been in wars for what?
No, what I was saying was that there's a documentary called The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire, and there's other documentaries and other writers and researchers who kind of believe that it's the U.S. has only been an extension to the British Empire. So the U.S. is basically just continuing what England was doing with you know, being an empire. Do you kind of feel like it is that, or do you think that it's its own identity, it's its own thing, a living thing?
Well, I mean, again, this is the basis of the book that I wrote, New World Order. It's exactly how the U.S. was co-opted to become an extension of the British Empire. Frankly, some would argue that America was designed to be as such. The New Atlantis principle, Francis Bacon wrote, right? That essentially we would be an empire from the start. That was the origin of the idea of what America was meant to be, was this empire of what used to be Atlantis of the ancient world, right? Expanding in this, what was called the New World at the time. America was designed to basically become this major power of the world with technology and militarism. And ultimately we are at the point where we either will fall as the old Atlanteans did, or in this time around, I believe, we actually will learn the lessons and transcend into the new, let's say, a new earth, a new age that will be distinguished from the old times of the perpetual rise and fall of empires.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like there has been some consciousness, some awakening, for lack of a better word, with people. I feel like people have become more aware. I mean, maybe it's just the power of the internet, having access to shows like, you know, your show, Watching the Hawks, and Buzzsaw, and your documentaries and your work, and podcasts like mine that have open discussion and conversations. I think people are more aware, but in a way, it's almost been co-opted too, where it's. I feel like initially, I remember, you know, growing up, like, I was so excited about the internet because I could get all these alternative views on history. I could get all these really interesting stories of corruption and conspiracies that I wasn't getting in school. But now it's gotten to the point where it's like it's almost information overload. It's like you can find a contradicting opinion that, you know, on almost any story, where it does feel like it's hard to filter out, you know, what's fact and what's fiction and what's I hate to say it, but what's fake news, you know, and but the other thing is too, it's like, how do we decide who dictates what's fake news, you know? And I guess truth in general can be very subjective, you know. It's like, well, somebody's interpreting this story this way, and somebody's, you know, so it's like, is there truth with a capital T, where people can just say, hey, you know, this is the truth, and this is what actually happened, this is facts, and let's filter out the rest? Or, you know, but people are also blurring opinion and facts. So I guess my point is that it seems like there's almost so much information that now, even for a researcher, it's hard to find out, you know, what's really going on. And, you know, you work on a show, Watching the Hawks, with Tyrell and Tabitha, which you guys keep up with current events and stuff like that. And do you find it hard to kind of, when you're researching a story, to kind of cut through the bullshit and get to what's actually going on? Or and also, do you think you're the fans of the show and people who are watching, do you think just for the average Joe, they struggle to find reliable news sources and whatnot?
So it's a long question.
Yes, it was more like a rant.
The issue of truth. The issue of truth is always interesting to me.
Yeah, same here.
I just put out a documentary called MetaHuman. Yeah, we just on RT just aired a documentary called MetaHuman. I put it on my YouTube channel and on bitmovie.io, which is a new streaming site. MetaHuman is mainly conversations with Deepak Chopra, amongst some other thinkers who are a mixture of neuroscientists, filmmakers, storytellers, Elon Musk, stock interviews in there, like trying to basically get at what is human consciousness, where are we going with human consciousness, because it's a human experience. All of truth is a human oriented truth, right? It's something that you personally must come to. There is no truth that is universal, let's say, except that which can be come to within the knowledge of your own soul. Everything that we talk about when it comes to like facts are very, you know, very, very limited. You know, there's limited specific events that can be said, like, this is a fact and that's a fact. Most of the experience most of the fact or the truth is an experience. It's an experience of events. It's an experience of reality. It's an experience of being, in the world, right? And so the documentary gets very much into this question of what is reality when truth is so subjective. And actually the reality is very much your reality versus my reality versus you know, my girlfriend's reality versus your dog's reality. They're all different realities. And that's fine. People have to get over this notion that there has to be some objective, concrete thing called the physical world. It's a morphic place. What we live in is a very morphic reality. And it's a planet that is morphic. And the more people get used to that idea, the more they'll be able to create new realities, each with reality structured for money, manipulation of perceptions for the profit of a few. Okay, it's a reality that's been created by others. The sooner you come to realize how malleable reality is, the sooner you'll be able to transcend it and start to create the world that you want to live in.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, and it's so true. Like I've gotten in debates with my used to be my co-host Dave Kernacki, who actually I think you know Susan Kernacki, but
they're related.
Yeah, they used to be married.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, because Susan's very much, I think, more of the line of what I was just saying. In terms of, I know her work is very much about the subjective consciousness and the energy that we bring to create reality.
Yeah, they were married a long time. It was funny because Dave's been telling me forever. He's like, Susan would make such a great guest on your show. I'm like, well, you're gonna have to co-host with me if she is. And then he's like, oh, I don't know about that, you know. But he used to do the show with me when I first started the podcast. It was just him and I, and we just have conversations about everything and anything, and then a lot of stuff that was subjective and kind of. And the nice thing is we're both willing to have our ideas challenged and have open discussions about stuff. But he always had really well thought out opinions, so he was always a really interesting friend to kind of record conversations with. But we once had this conversation about like, are there any universal truths? And you know, I tend to disagree that there are any, you know, universal truths. Like he, for example, he said like murder. You know, I think he used the example that murder, you know, like universally we can decide murder is a bad thing. And it's like, well, even that, something that seems so cut and dry, you can be the devil's advocate and you can argue that. I mean, you can have somebody who, for religious reasons, thinks that murdering somebody because of something they've done is justified, you know, or you know, it's examples like that. So I think that there's always, that's what makes philosophy to me so interesting. And it's just, it's constant. I mean, in a way, you're discussing things that really you never solve and you never really get to an answer. But I think having these discussions are important because it makes you, even if it just opens your mind to the fact that so much that we think is solved and resolved isn't resolved, and there's still so many questions and things that we've kind of just accepted as this is the way things are, this is the way we think. And then when you go and you analyze the way you think and you analyze why you feel a certain way, or you know, or why you've accepted some truth, you realize that truth you accepted really isn't true at all. And I think that's so important. Just the whole, just question, even something as simple as just questioning what the hell is truth, you know. And like Thaddeus Russell, very often, you know, gets in these debates with, you know, what is true? Is there a universal truth? Is, you know, and there's not. I don't feel like there is. And I agree with you. I think that there is, and even consciousness, like you were talking about, like if we downloaded our consciousness prior to this conversation and then post this conversation, it might be slightly different, you know. So it's like who we are today compared to who we are tomorrow, based on our life experiences and what we go through and interactions with people, it's always slightly changing, and it should. So, you know, when you talk about like the future of like possibly downloading consciousness into robots or whatnot, it doesn't seem like it's something that we'll ever quite be able to do, because it's like, I'm not sure we'll ever really quite understand what is consciousness. And even if we do, could you ever bottle it up in a ball and hold on to it? And can you say, this is me? That, and it's not. It's like, it's you right now, but it's not you who you are a week from now or 2 weeks from now or a year from now, you know? So it's, these are all super interesting discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so essentially, I think these are the questions that we raised in the documentary in MetaHuman, so people should check it out if they want to get deeper into it. But as far as universal truth is concerned, well, I believe that there's universal law at least laws that do apply across our conception of the universe. It's a multiverse, and we're talking multiple dimensions and other, you know, as already in the realm of quantum physics, a lot of laws that operate at the grand scale go out the window. So we talk about universal law, but that's not truth. I think Keats got it best when he said, "Truth is beauty, beauty truth." And then, as we know, each person has their own conception of beauty.
Yeah, and we're so limited by our senses. You know, I've had Rupert Sheldrick on, and his research is always so fascinating, and epigenetics too. You know, just there's so much that we're still uncovering and we don't understand. I mean, the placebo effect. I mean, you just think about that alone, like the power of the mind. And
power of intention.
Yeah, power of intention. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, the studies that they've done with, like, you know, things as simple as putting trees and some beautiful nature type of scenery outside of a hospital window, and people recover faster than when they see just more building. And, you know, telling people that they've had surgery, knee surgery, when they really haven't, and then you know, they feel better. And do you know who Dr. Soronos is? He wrote the book Mind Over Back Pain.
No, don't know that book.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, because he was like one of the leading back surgeons in the U.S. And what he found interesting was that there's people who had really messed up backs, you know, the discs were all messed up and stuff like that, and should really have high pain. And they were saying they didn't have high pain. And then there's people who had really messed up backs, or vice versa. They, you know, that didn't really have backs that were that messed up, that were coming up on MRIs and X-rays, and they had high pain. And he's like, where is the consistency to this? Like, why is one person, you know, according to these X-rays and MRIs, show a really messed up, you know, spine, and yet he doesn't have high pain, and this person does? And, like, he just saw this inconsistency. So he started kind of brainstorming the idea that maybe it wasn't the physical part of what he was seeing that was causing the pain, but maybe it was some mental internal part. And so he would ask questions, like talk to them and be like, hey, you know, are you going through some life experiences, a death in the family? Are you between jobs? Are you having some issues with significant other? You know, all these other things. And what he found out was that there was these, what he observed was that people who were having some type of emotional or mental issues or pain, you know, their bodies were finding a weak point to kind of release that pain. So what was really causing the pain wasn't the physical, but it was the mental. And most people, after having these conversations with them and kind of putting in perspective that, hey, what was causing the pain isn't really the, you know, the disc that's moving and pinching a nerve or whatever, but it's actually more than that. It's deeper than that. It's actually mental, that most people actually felt better just from the conversation. And so we ended up writing this book, Mind Over Back Pain, kind of dictating this story of how, you know, basically even some pain can be completely just created by emotions or your mind, and you can think it's a physical issue, but it's actually a mental issue.
Well, see, it's not just that. It's okay. So the fun thing is, it's much deeper than that, because all of physical reality is first and foremost an expression from the spiritual, which is psycho-emotional existence. So there is no physical reality. Physical reality literally is manifested from the psycho-emotional existence. And when people, they hate to hear that, because we've been operating in victim mentality for so many eons, well, I don't want to say eons, but let's say thousands of years. It's very much a control apparatus of how we've been designed, let's say designed and run in this factory farm called Earth. So the victim, that is, you know, the human being since we're born, doesn't feel empowered to say, oh, I can create my own reality. Oh, I can do whatever I want. The victim is basically the psyche, basically that's abused, that's hurt, and told, you know, you just got to deal with it. That's the way life is. Life isn't fair. You know, go out there and you got to, you know, tough it out and repress your emotions, as opposed to feeling your emotions, as opposed to going into your emotions and actually having the experience of what is pain. Pain is actually a smoke signal. It's literally just a smoke signal saying, hey, I need help here, right? Pain in your pain. If you break a bone, it's the pain is saying, oh, I need help, so that the blood can rush there and pay attention to it. The same on a psychic level. When we're in pain or we're depressed or we're feeling sad, we're not told to to go to that place and go into it and go really deep into it and bring effect to it and love it and embrace it, we're told to just shut it up, repress it, tough it out, right? So how can we heal? And as a result, we don't heal. So what happens to all that, that whole thing is dammed. All that energy is dammed up until the dikes break, the levee breaks. And then what? It explodes into different expressions of illness. But to me, it's very important to do this, the psycho-spiritual work. I mean, whether it's what this doctor is doing through talk. I know with meditation, I've done meditation since I was 15. It's a very powerful practice. Prayer, as we know, is a powerful technique. Breath work is a new, is something that's coming out now more in the West that, you know, I've gotten introduced to through Sacred Breath Academy. It's basically teaching us to breathe, because we don't even know how to breathe as humans. We don't take enough oxygen into our bodies.
Have you
so
tried
of course our cells are, you know, are releasing free radicals and basically destroying themselves because we're not oxygenating properly. So I mean, certainly I'm someone that like believes in workout, and I've, you know, worked out, you know, most days of my life. But you know, beyond workout, there's techniques you can do literally just to work on oxidating and bringing oxygen, so that you're not you know, again, you're not allowing your cells to decompose from lack of oxygen and too much sugar, because that's certainly what we're full of in this society.
Yeah,
so these are just important things to be aware of, to start to incorporate into your being, so that your being is ultimately ease. Because what is a disease? Is it dis-ease, right? Disease is a dis-ease. And rather than treating it like, oh, this is a great teacher, this is something that we can learn from or we can use to catalyze our change, our growth, our evolution, we look at it and we're like, oh no, this is a bad thing. We have to kill it with drugs and pills and get rid of it. But it's not going to get, you're not going to get rid of it until you actually address the roots of the problem.
Have you experimented with the Wim Hof method?
Yeah, no, I love a little bit of Wim Hof. Wim Hof is fine. It's a good technique, especially you know, if you want to build up resistance and tolerance and homeostasis. The breath work that I do is deeper. It's more for meditation. It's more for going into altered states and really going into psychic and to your own psyche and your memories of, like, even past life memories come up. A lot of, you know, trauma, bloodline trauma, what's called genetic memory that we carry from our ancestors comes up. So I think breath work is a little more profound. I think Wim Hof is great as an introduction. It's good for health, but breath work, like I'm saying, like I work with Sacred Breath Academy. That's where I would say breath work gets you deeper, doing those 2-hour sessions. And once you do the 2-hour sessions, then you can do the 20-minute, you know, daily check-ins with yourself.
Yeah, there's a, I think, I forget what the article's called, but I remember talking to Rupert Sheldrick about it. I think it's like Inheriting Father's Fears. And it's it was about, you know, you talked about, you know, the trauma from your DNA, how it gets passed along, and you know, they've done experiments with that, with, you know, where they sprayed, I'm sure you're familiar with the experiment where they sprayed the scent with the mice, and every time they sprayed the scent, they would shock the mice, and so every time they would smell that scent, they'd have like a panic reaction to it. So for two generations afterwards, the children and then the grandchildren, every time they sprayed, and it was a scent that they would never find in nature, and they wouldn't recognize or know. Every time they sprayed this scent, without ever being shocked, the kids and the grandkids would have the same panic effect, response to it. So it's, you know, it's the epigenetics and the idea that, like, you know, sometimes we might be even dealing with trauma, not even stuff that we've dealt with in our own lives, but maybe, you know, our parents or grandparents that were passed along.
Precisely. And that's the whole issue that we're dealing with actually as a species right now, is to heal the wounds. This is the moment where we're working to heal the wounds, to take the time internally to heal the damage to ourselves, to our souls, to our soul family, and to our genetic lineage. And in that healing, to then allow a new earth to open that's based more in heart space, that's based more in love, reciprocity, the actual teachings of Christ, not the bastardized teachings of the church.
Now, how much, you know, so, you know, we talk about all this, you know, finding, and the last podcast I did, we talked a lot about, you know, finding fulfillment and spirituality and the benefits of it. And you know, finding a place in life that where you're happy, and then what is happiness and all this stuff. But how much of the, I guess, for a lack of a better word, the elite or those in power, you know, the people who, you know, the the people that are really trying to manipulate social, you know, and have social control and manipulate the population, how much of what they're doing, like, you know, you talk about sugar. I'm a big fan of Gary Tobbs, and I've done tons of shows on diet and nutrition, and it really is a conspiracy how they've added just made sugar a big part of our diets, and I think it has a huge effect on cognitive function, because, you know, your brain needs healthy fats, and if you can get your body in ketosis, it runs better off ketones and then fats for energy. And how much, you know, stuff like that, you know, because you hear about fluoride and all these things that historically have maybe been used for suppression of cognitive ability and imagination and critical thinking. How much of what do you think is going on is really a suppression of maybe people finding some spiritual happiness and fulfillment? And do you think it's a conscious effort, you know, with the, like you said, the sugar, the you know, just the dumbing down of America? Do you think it's a conscious effort, or is it as simple as just capitalism kind of doing what it does, and that's people doing anything it takes to make quarterly gains and you know, work on that bottom line?
Guidance will start now.
Oh, navigation just joined the podcast.
1 mile, exit 93 is on the left.
All right, 1 second. I'm just gonna get my route guidance going.
Yeah, no problem.
Yeah, I would say it's, of course it's conscious, man. That's my point. This is someone else's reality that we've been living in. And until we start to educate ourselves and start to wake up to our own understanding of what's going on, we cannot live our own life. We're living by other people's conditioning, structures, beliefs, you know, patterning. It's all there. It's all there for generations. And it's the problem is that we've been, you know, we've basically been just kind of, we've been lulled to sleep, you know, by the ease of it all. Just like the idea of, well, it's easy. Just go to McDonald's and get, you know, and get your burger for dinner. It's easier than cooking something, you know, slow cooking something. The ease of money has allowed us to forget what mattered was who we work with. If we're working with people that we like, that's wonderful. But if we're just taking the paycheck and we work for corporations that have no heart or no character, if we work for people like Harvey Weinstein just because, you know, he's rich, you see the ease of money allow people to forget what it was meant being human. We're here with the capacity for empathy, for love, for understanding, and to deepen into our souls, not to let go of our souls and just live for the moment.
Yeah, I think community and connection is super important. I've had so many conversations with guests about that, and just I come from immigrant parents. I came to this country when I was young, and I was born in Portugal, and it was just, they were so concerned about trying to financially get ahead when they came to this country and you know, live a better life and create a better life, and a lot of that just kind of revolved around trying to make more money. And I feel like, you know, you end up getting lost in this kind of false American dream, this kind of this idea of like, oh, if you end up buying this beautiful house and getting this new car and all this stuff, hey, you're living the American dream, you're gonna be happy. And then you see this uprise of antidepressants and anxiety and people self-medicating with drugs and alcohol and whatnot. And we live in the most, you know, depressed population and unhappy population ever. And, you know, they've done studies with, I forget what it is, like once you make more than $70,000 a year or something like that, like it has no effect on your happiness levels. And so I think, yeah, what you're saying is absolutely important. I think finding fulfillment, finding a community, being around your friends, laughing, you know, experiencing those moments are super important. And I think we can get really caught up into just, you know, again, and this social control, like this idea we've been sold, you know, this goes, you know, which, as you know very well, you know, Edward Bernays and marketing and telling you that if you buy this product, it will bring you happiness. And I think a lot of people have gone down that road, and that it's supposed to lead to happiness. And then you go down that road and you realize you're not happy. So, and then you end up buying more shit to make up for your unhappiness, which means you have to, you know, because you created more debt, you have to work more. And it just is a vicious cycle of, that's why I think debt is such a strong tool of social control, because once people are stuck, you know, especially right out of college, you're stuck with that huge debt. Once you're stuck, you don't have flexibility. You have to work probably a job you dislike. You don't, you know, you end up buying a house you could probably barely afford. And then you're stuck paying all this debt, and you don't have any freedom, and your whole life revolves around just paying off this debt. You know, all your blood, sweat, and tears goes to working a job you dislike to pay for a debt that was kind of supposed to bring you happiness. You know, so it does seem like a really just sick trick. Did I lose it?
No, I'm here.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
You hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, so it is.
And, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. So yeah. So in regards to like what's going on in the world today, coming from somebody who does keep up with current events and news and stuff like that, I think one issue I find is it's hard to know what is important and what isn't important, because there's so much, especially since Trump has become president, there's just so much stuff in the news. It's almost like information overkill. There's so much going on, and I think we can get so caught up with the drama of everyday politics that you realize like none of this shit is really important, and none of the, you know, it's kind of like a puppet show. You know, they have you watching the puppets, but then you lose track of like the fact that everybody's kind of working for the same people, and the same people are pulling the strings and whatnot. Do you feel like, you know, it's a lot of current events is just, it is just a puppet show, that we shouldn't be paying attention to this type of stuff, and there is a bigger picture that people are kind of losing track of as they get caught up in this. These little just seems kind of pointless.
Yeah, I mean, who told you to watch current events in the first place?
Yeah, well, that's true.
I mean, this is my point, you know, like who told you how to behave? Who told you what's relevant? You know, ultimately, how often do you check in with yourself and find what actually is relevant to you? Because, you know, we can see our consciousness has expanded far beyond that of a man 100 years ago. But the question is, like, at what point do we actually, like, need this information? At what point is it just, like, I just have random facts of knowledge in my head, but it's not actually affecting my being, or it's not, I should say, it's maybe clouding my spirit or affecting my spirit, but actually my spirit doesn't need to know that. Or just, it's like, you can know if you can let it go. You can be detached. It is a puppet show. The point is, they want to manipulate you into situations, environments of fear, and to feeling like debased and in debt and in powerless. And that's what they're doing. They manipulate people into that belief structure, so they just give up. And it's to say, no, I don't give up. I just look at it like a detached observer, saying this is all that we see on the world stage is an expression of human psyche, the collective unconscious. So what's most important is for me to address my own unconscious. I can't affect all collective unconscious except by addressing my own unconscious part of myself, my own being the change that I want to see, being the person that I want to be, and letting that have the effect and having ripples sound the effect of zeitgeist, just by opening up your own light and your own you know, relationship to soul and affecting those around you. You know, if we've seen these clouds, like these clouds of smoke from San Francisco that caught a jet stream and ended up in New York, right? Well, the same thing happens on a spiritual level. If you hook up with a bunch of people who are on the same wavelength, you start movements, you start revolutions that way. Not from intending to, just because people at the right place in the right time catch the right wave, and next thing you know, they're affecting people all over the world. So why am I watching current events? What does that have to do with me? I'm just going to sit here and do my work, inner work, expression, art. Art is one of the most important things human beings can do on an individual basis, whether it's cooking, painting, drawing, writing, composing, playing music, whatever it is, just doing your art, expressing your soul and your heart, and working really to just unmask and like excavate the different aspects of yourself that are hidden, then you're doing the work. This will fall into place naturally. It was always a puppet show, but it was just, they told you to watch the show rather than doing like, stop watching the show, go out into the sunshine, find out what your truth is. And then, you know, you start to spread it and you see who catches it, who starts to recognize it. Yeah, there's another reality out there. Let go of the puppet show.
Yeah, that's such an important message, because people knowing I do this podcast, I get people asking me all the time, like, oh, what do you think about the Cohen thing? Or what do you think about? And I'm always like, honestly, I'm not paying much attention to it because it doesn't seem that relevant. Like, just knowing what's going on, like you said, like, I know we're watching the Hawks because it's a show that kind of talks about what's going on you know, in current events, you know, I'm sure that Tyrell, Tabitha, and yourself kind of have to, at times, keep up a little bit with what's going on in everyday news. But I think I completely agree. I know we can, people get so caught up in just, you know, this puppet show. And also, just like you said, knowing information for information's sake. I remember when I had Daniele Bignelli on last, he's a professor, he's an author, historian, but he's also a believer in knowing, like, just regurgitating names and dates and historical events and all this stuff without any relevance to how it can improve your life or your understanding of the world around you is completely pointless, you know? I completely agree. I think sometimes somebody can come off very intelligent by just regurgitating stuff they memorize, but if that doesn't help you understand yourself or the world around you, then what good is it? You know, is it really important? Mm-hmm. Should you really be wasting your time
exactly.
doing that? Yeah, that's, I think, you know, and this is a huge issue, like you've been hitting on, just the idea of spending more time doing creative things, doing, you know, like yourself being a filmmaker, you know, working on music, doing, you know, whatever it may be, poetry, writing, you know, I think tapping into that is so important, because if not, you just become this robot, this machine that kind of just continues doing, you know, the same thing over and over again. And it's funny, because I've had Hunter Motz on, who wrote the book The Straight A Conspiracy, and he talked about how early they asked a bunch of kids in, like, I don't know if it was third grade or when they were really young, like, hey, how many of you kids find yourselves creative and have a vast imagination? And, like, every kid raised their hands. And as you ask older kids, less kids raise their hands, you know? And so it gets to a point where, and you know, I write music, and I remember people, like, telling me, like, oh, how do you write a song? I could never do that. I'm like, we can all do it. Like, we all, when we're kids, we all imagine. We're all creative. We all play with blocks. We all play games that take imagination, or we color, or we draw, whatever it may be. But the thing is, as we get older, we stop exercising those muscles and those talents, and eventually they kind of go away. And I think we're all capable of that. And like you've said, it definitely is a conscious effort to kind of get people to pursue jobs and pursue careers and do these things. Like, oh, worry about things that are going to make you money. Don't worry about being creative or imagination or anything that's going to get you out of thinking, you know, looking at things the way we want you to think and look at things. Yeah, I think those are super important messages, and the power that, you know, I named this podcast the Ripple Effect Podcast, because I truly believe in the ripple effect, the power that we all have in creating a, you know, sharing positive energy and creating a ripple and having a actual effect on the world, I think is understated. I think we can all seriously have a effect, and you know, the fact that you've been doing meditation since, you know, your teens is pretty wild, you know, that even as an adult you continue it. And I'm sure there's some serious, you know, just trauma or internal thoughts or ideas and that you have figured out during that meditation. So I think it's super important. Do you think...
Absolutely.
When we talk about, like, you know, because a lot of times when we're talking about, or when you're having conversations like we're having today, like, we use the words they a lot, and we use, you know, they're... Oh, I think I lost you. Are you still there? You still there?
No, I'm just... Okay.
Yeah. When we use the word they, a lot of times people are like, well, who's they? You know, who's suppressing us? Who's doing this? Who's controlling us? Like... Do you ever get people who ask you that? And if so, how do you answer something like that? Still there?
Yeah, right.
Hello?
Yeah, I got you now. I think I was up in the hill country, so.
Where are you located now?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm passing through Riverside, so it's a little bit hilly, which is beautiful. But I guess the service cut out.
Yeah. Yeah, what I was saying is, like, you know, when we use the words they and we use
I got the question. What I was saying is that, well, they are interdimensional beings as we are. We are all multidimensional beings. We are the ones, humans, that have forgotten that we are multidimensional, and other beings that are not seen by our naked eye know that they are multidimensional, so they can affect us, influence us more.
But
no worries.
Yeah, so I guess what we can end the conversation with I guess something I was actually watching your documentary that's on I found it on your YouTube channel, MetaHuman, you know, talking about transhumanism and some of the stuff that we're talking about today, and something, and then actually I received an email from, you know who, he was just recently on the Rogan podcast, but Andrew Yang. He's the kind of the guy running as president, but he's kind of focused on universal basic income and all that stuff. And it kind of ties into what we were talking about, because I think the need for universal basic income are because of, a problem that's going to eventually we're going to have to deal with. And that's automation and robots taking jobs. And then eventually there's going to be all these people that are going to need something to do. And you look at truck driving and you look at retail, and those are two jobs, you know, huge jobs in America. There's a lot of truck drivers, a lot of people who do retail. And yet those are the jobs that are kind of going to, it looks like going to disappear the quickest. And there's going to be all these people looking for shit to do. And I think universal income, when you say it, a lot of people just think socialism. They think, oh, you know, what an awful idea. We can't afford it. As you know, and I know, we spend more than enough money on military and war and bombing people that if we cut some of that cost, we could easily afford universal basic income. But I think the other thing too is that I think, you know, some of the stuff that we're talking about in regards to, you know, even just the what motivates people, you know, it's we think that money is the motivator, but really, you look at Nikola Tesla and great thinkers. I mean, they're motivated by their work. They're motivated by trying to make the world a better place. And maybe if we had a universal basic income where people spend or had more free time and did less, you know, spend less time on labor intensive stuff, maybe in the long run, it would help quicken this progress to this universal consciousness of realizing that we're more than just these machines that are supposed to do these labor-intensive things for just material wealth. And what's your opinion on universal basic income? Do you think that it would be a positive thing in regards to giving people more time to work on the things that you were talking about, like meditation, imagination, music, stuff that involves creativity?
Of course, of course. I mean, that's a major... Look, there's a lot of facets to get into here. The first and most important question is that why do people assume that money needs to operate the way that it does? Like, this monetary system that we have is something that was created essentially within the construct of a central bank lending money, right? So the Federal Reserve System lends money to the various branches and the various, you know, major large banks like the, you know, JP Morgan's and the Chase Citibank, you know, etc. So it's a system of debt, right? And essentially the entire planet is in debt slavery, as we know. There's the idea was capitalism was a great idea insofar it was supposed to redistribute wealth. Like, the reason that capitalism worked for such a long period of time was it took wealth from, you know, let's say I have land and I have an estate and I have, you know, title or whatever, and I can use that to basically, you know, that wealth to invest in entrepreneurial things, into businesses, you know, corporations, other people's endeavors, right? It redistributes wealth. Well, we've seen what's happened with capitalism. Capitalism has allowed, especially this monopoly capitalism that's existed within the monetary system we have, it allows for a centralization of power such that you basically have 1,000 corporations. The Swiss study done back in 2012 was about how, like, there's like over 1,000 corporations interlocking boards that control like 40% of the planet's wealth. So essentially this model of capitalism is bust. 8 people have as much wealth as half of the planet, okay? We have more slaves today than ever in history. It's time to wake up. Like, that system doesn't work because it didn't actually redistribute wealth. It gave the illusion of redistributing wealth. Ultimately, as we saw, it put most people into debt, and it put basically like it consolidated more and more wealth into a smaller class of people. So what needs to happen is moving away from this notion of capital and controls and monopolies into more of a system of reciprocity, more of a system of, like, you know, how do you say, going more towards like local trade. But even local can be local over the internet now, because you can do direct currency exchanges through cryptos and other currencies, right? We can create alternative societies. We can create new ways, which are really just old ways of being in the world, that are not monopolized by a central banking system and debt slavery. And that's the fundamental mental shift that has to take place. In the meantime, universal basic income can help. I'm all for that concept, because I do think that robots should replace the slave factor, the fact that we have people doing very monotonous slave type of jobs that's mundane and extraneous to their creativity, like it's extraneous to their to our needs. I think you can replace that with robots doing those jobs, and then essentially allowing people to have more creative endeavors. But that's the beauty, is that we're entering a world where the more people have free time to create and get their job, let's say, like, you know, the 4-hour work week kind of concept, right? Where it's like you have more time to just create, less time spent working on menial things and managing tasks, and more time in the creative process. That also includes spending time watching things, engaging in things. I mean, think about this. You have platforms like Facebook and Instagram and others that are valued for billions of dollars. Their actual wealth is purely the people that are using it. The people that are on Instagram, the people that are on Facebook, are generating the entire wealth of that corporation, but the people using it don't see any of the profit. How does that make sense?
Yeah, that's interesting.
So you see, we have a world where the problem is the perception is all off. The perception is still stuck in capitalism, free market capitalism versus socialism. None of these things really ever existed. It was all controlled from a hierarchical perspective by central banks and the control of money supplies. The beauty of the new world, especially through virtual realities, windows, internet-based blockchains, for example, and cryptocurrencies, is that people will be able to choose to operate in societies that are probably more like, you know, the Native Americans or, you know, ancient civilizations, more maybe barter-based, more based in, you know, creativity and exertion where you need to. And oftentimes, you know what? Not having to do something, not having to feel like I need to be busy all the time. That's all a construct of a worldview that wanted people to be slaves. And said, basically, if you're not getting up and working at 9 a.m. till 5 p.m., you're a bum. Right?
Yeah.
That was meant to put people into slavery. That's what a slave was. So they put us into that worldview that this is how you have to earn a living, like a slave. And it misses the point that actually our creativity, where you know, the fact that I'm watching your movie as the consumer actually, you know, makes me valuable to your movie, whether it's a movie, a TV show, I'm active on Instagram. I the consumer, I'm giving value to your company, but I'm not honored as such. The mentality is only about accumulating more and more capital into the top of the pyramid. But meanwhile, all the people that make up the base of the pyramid, once they start to say, wait a minute, why am I supporting this pyramid? It's on my back. And they let it go, the pyramid collapses.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So how far do you think we are from a world that's different than we live in today, where we end up having to kind of give up on this, you know, this crazy idea that you either have to have a capitalistic, you know, economy or socialistic economy,
right,
or whatnot? Do you think this is something, you know, right around the corner? Do you think that this is something that we can ponder on, but they're just going to be people in control that are going to try to hold on to their power that they have now to, you know, because it doesn't seem like when things change in that direction that it would be beneficial to them.
I think that essentially we are on the brink, on the verge, and whether that's tomorrow, whether that's in 10 years, 20 years, it doesn't really matter. What matters is the shift in perception, the shift in consciousness. And it's inevitable, you know, because these systems that we've been operating under cannot sustain themselves. This system that we're operating under is collapsing, and how it collapses, how the collapse is managed, how maybe there's, like, you know, a shift in the global currency reset, so-called, like, you know, how they reshift the currency. It's just a question of what that new world order looks like, essentially. But the order is going to shift. It's can't, you know, you can't maintain this monetary empire. It's too absurd. The environment, obviously, is being destroyed in the process. And I'm not talking about global warming. I'm just talking about basic things like plastic pollution, like, you know, cutting down the rainforest. I mean, things that literally you can observe and see the damage and devastation it does to all of us. You know, this kind of this these factors are what is forcing the consciousness shift. I mean, it's all part of the same moment, in a sense. So it's not a question of when. I'm not here to forecast and say it's, you know, next month or something. It's just, it's literally just a question of wake up. The sooner each individual shifts their consciousness and starts to realize, why am I doing this? And I don't want to just be a slave to someone else's, for someone else's profit. And essentially, I don't want to feel like my value is being diluted, and actually start to esteem themselves as individuals and start to love themselves as individuals. It will all go hand in hand.
Well, I guess some of the reason why I was asking, you know, how far are we from this is because I'm curious on the ones that are trying to, you know, Monsanto, the Bayers, the central banks, all the people that are having such control over the way we eat, the way we live, the policies, everything. Like, do you think they see it as a issue that they have to figure out immediately? How do they control the public when the public does reach to a point where they do have, I guess, for lack of a better term, like some type of conscious awakening?
Right. Well,
sorry, I didn't mean to end it with such a big question.
That's what I'm talking about, though. Like, the public is who I'm talking about. The public is, all right, on one level, there is no external reality. That's the problem people face. They're trying to shift consciousness. They're trying to wake people up. There is nothing to wake up. Wake yourself up. Wake yourself up, and I promise you it will all happen for you. Because your reality will be different from my reality, will always be different. Each of our realities will always be different. But the point is that as we awaken, we start to recognize this global, you know, shift. It doesn't mean that people, you know, people there, listen, right now there are people living in the Amazon that can't even fathom what we're doing driving around in these cities. Okay? There are nomads still wandering the desert, living life that you would have seen 1,000 years ago. Yeah. There are people in Japan that are more high tech than you are. Right? History is right now, it's like an even playing field. You can see all of history right now before your eyes. But all that matters is you. For your existence. All that matters for my existence is me. How do I perceive the world? The rest is really just, again, well, like, there's no way of speaking about it. I can never speak to you about someone else's consciousness.
I guess what I was asking is, like, you know, I think we both kind of tend to agree that the lives we live have been manipulated, and there's people who are purposely trying to make us kind of sheeple and can, you know, there's some sense of social control and engineering. And if that's the case, do you think they see this conscious awakening? And if so, how do you think, like, do you think there's a plan, like, a way, do you think they understand what you're talking about? Do you think that they're at that level where they're like, okay, we know this is going to happen, and we have to some way control it or prevent it from happening? Do you think that's a conscious decision of theirs?
There is no external control. That's the beauty of the real mistake people make is believing that there was an external control. Actually, it was always done through through consent. We never dissented. You see, this is all according to universal law. Everything that we've allowed to can be constructed in this reality has been through our permission, because we never said no, because we never envisioned a different reality. We allowed this into creation, into formation, and now we're seeing the consequence, the logical consequence of everything that we've allowed to come into formation. We will see it through to the end. And then it's time to then wake, as I said, wake each of ourselves up and start to address what world we want to envision, what world we want to create. And that world will come into existence, and some of us will share it. Others will be in different realities. But essentially, every world that's created has to go through its logical conclusion. So there is nothing to worry about in a sense of the controllers or handlers. No, there's nothing to be, they cannot do anything, because we are in control. We have to remember that. Remember who you are. Remember that you are a spark of the prime creator. You are the source. You are the source of all of this. Not you, not little you, big you. And you've forgotten, you've fallen asleep, and you've allowed yourself to go into this dream state, to allow for the, you know, to consent to this world, and ultimately you realize this is hell. So it's time to wake up and get out of it and start a new one. And that's really what's happening.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's why I think these conversations are so important, because it's so easy to get caught up in just, like you said, of accepting that this is the way things have to be, this is the way things are, this is our current understanding, and there's a reason why things are the way they are, because this is the way it should be. And you know, I know there's people who love and hate the Zeitgeist movies, but when they first came out and I watched them, I thought they were super important for people to kind of dissect, you know, just kind of, I guess, rethink what they thought was possible, you know. And regardless if you believe that, you know, their type of future was possible, this idea of like just sharing and all this stuff, but it was just interesting to think that it doesn't have to be this way. There could be other ways. And you know, I'm a father of two beautiful kids, and you know, I think about that myself, like how you know, when they're born, it's kind of a clean slate. You know, it's a computer with no information, and you're teaching them about the world, and every piece of information you're giving them is creating what they understand of the world. It's creating their perception of the world, but that could be anything. And you know, and so we're all kind of like that. We're all just kind of children growing up, and we have all these people influencing the way we think and the way we feel and what we think is possible. And I think we do have to break out of that mold. And you know, I think it's interesting having these conversations, because I think that people do need to stop and realize that maybe it is a internal battle, you know, that not just external, you know, but internal. And yeah, it's super interesting. I can't thank you enough, Sean, for being with me. I think these, like I said, these conversations are super important. We definitely don't spend enough time doing things like meditation and all the creative things we talked about to help, I guess, further, you know, tap into you know, ourselves and some type of spirituality in our lives, I think is important. I was raised a Catholic and kind of rebelled against that, but as I get older, I kind of see the benefits of being spiritual and in some cases how religion helps people realize that there's more important things to life than just you know, consuming and trying to financially get ahead and work. So I think my opinion has changed throughout the years on religion multiple times. But yeah, thanks a lot, Sean. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you got it. No, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And yes, the revolution, as I always, you know, in Buzzsaw, you know, you are the revolution. I was always the tagline of Buzzsaw, and it's true. I mean, you, yourself, me, myself, you know, each person that can hear this message, you are the revolution. Start with within, working within. Work on yourself, and I promise everything that you work on internally, you will see the difference in the outcome externally. It's just like if someone, you know, when you start doing the muscle work, right, and you go to the gym and you work out, and people look at you differently, and you feel more confident, right? That's just the most basic level of understanding. But the gym work also is a psycho-spiritual work. It's like going deep into yourself, and the more you do, the more you will see the consequence externally. So that's the message. Check out my YouTube channel, Sean Stone. YouTube channel has some good new Buzzsaw interviews, and MetaHuman is on there, and bitmovie.io, bitmovio. I'm putting the next evolution of Buzzsaw will be on there for people to watch. And then I also would suggest Sacred Breath Academy. I mentioned sacredbreath.life if you want to get into breath work.
Yeah. I haven't messed around too much with it. I've done the Wim Hof method quite a few times because I'm big into exercising and I play basketball and stuff. And it is pretty amazing what you could tap into just with breathing. I've had super sore legs and body, and just doing some of his exercises, it's amazing how, you know, you end up having a jolt of energy. And I've heard people like Aubrey Marcus talking about, you know, who's the owner on it, and he's done a lot of psychedelics, and he's talked about breathing, you know, doing some breathing practices that actually has gave him equal amount of spiritual, I guess, visions and feeling and experience as like some psychedelics. So I think something as simple as breathing, I think it is interesting what we're capable of doing with just something as simple as breathing.
Yep. That's why I would recommend it, you know, Sacred Breath Academy, check it out. And yeah, you know, people can check out my website, my YouTube for more. My website being my Facebook page and, you know, Instagram, Twitter, all that, YouTube.
And you're still from occasion on watching the Hawks, right?
Yeah, I mean, I do interviews on Watching the Hawks. Those are interviews with people that I think are interesting on the current event side. But as I said, for me, like, it's not about the current events. It's really about the internal work right now and what we're doing on a spiritual, creative level for each one of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Sam Tripoli says the revolution will be podcasted, and I think that podcasting, films, documentaries, all this stuff, I think is really having some type of ripple effect, and little by little, I think we are probably, hopefully, moving in the right direction. So thanks a lot, John. I really appreciate it. Enjoy the rest of your trip, and hopefully we reconnect sometime in the near future.
Perfect. Sounds good.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
Take care. I believe in the ripple effect.